We're heading to Gastown, hauling gasoline. No, we're hauling Aqua Cola.
Yeah.
Yeah. Neither of those are Four Locos, Aaron.
No, they're iced tea.
Why wouldn't each one is like two locos when you combine them?
I just feel like if you're going to get giant cans of beverage, they should be Four Locos.
You are now listening to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games. My name is Chris, and I'm coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. And like I do every single week, I brought a couple of NPCs along for the ride with me. To my right, hailing from the frozen tundra of the north, he is NPC Del. Del, how are you doing?
I'm excited.
How excited are you?
I'm very excited.
That's pretty exciting.
I'm so excited I don't have a superlative.
There hasn't been one invented.
Exactly.
At this point, he's not very excited.
I am.
Are you?
Yeah, for real.
Okay.
Realsies.
To my left, he is the man, the myth, the legend, the beard. He is NPC Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Your beard is looking a little bit like Kevin Nash-ish right now. It's got a little bit of gray in there, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's looking like a Kevin Nash.
Thanks, man. I really have been waiting to be compared to my hero.
Diesel.
Big sexy, whatever his dumb names are. Diesel.
Big Daddy.
Vinny Vegas. Oz.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
Super Shredder.
You're welcome. You are welcome. We have a very, very interesting show this week, and like all of our shows, it is brought to you by our fine backers at patreon.com/NPCcast. And I took a look at the Patreon page today, like I am prone to do from time to time, and we are 74.66% towards our $100 milestone goal there, which is to produce an actual print and play product that you can download yourself with the NPC Cast stamp of approval.
Quarterly. Yeah.
So as long as that continues, we will keep it up from quarter to quarter. But yeah, 74.66%, repeating, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Haven't gone down to the third decimal place yet. But
yeah, you haven't seen the tenths of cents that someone donated.
Yeah, exactly. So patreon.com is a way to basically donate to the show if you feel so inclined. You can give a dollar an episode, a quarter an episode, or $6.66 an episode like our good friend Duncan did. And we greatly appreciate that. Of course, it's not required. The shows will be free, but it does help us out if you feel so inclined to do that. We also have a big announcement to make as well. We want to put it at the top of the show. We did our recent character creation session for our next TPK, which is titled what, Aaron?
It is the City of Egress.
And what system will that be in?
It'll be in Monty Cook Games' Cypher system.
Yes, absolutely. So we did the character creation session. We recorded it via video stream. We live streamed it on twitch.tv/NPCcast. It's currently on YouTube right now at youtube.com/1000XP. Spell it out.
Yeah, and if you don't want to watch character creation, because that's not for everyone.
Correct.
By this time, there will have been probably the same day that this comes out, there will be an article on NPCcast.com that kind of has the world-building info and a map and the summaries of the characters.
Right, and we will be live-streaming those as we record them and then releasing them on the podcast feed and via video as well on the YouTube page. So there's a lot of ways to consume that. So make sure you go to youtube.com/1000XP and subscribe there if you want to see the videos when we bring them out. So yeah, there you go. Pretty cool stuff. It was a lot of fun. We had our good friend Matt on with us, and then we had our other good friend Stephanie Straw from the internet on there with us as well. So it's a lot of fun. The characters ended up cool.
Her and her tiny sculpture of your character, her tiny living
that was
puppet
creepy
of your character.
I still am. I had two nightmares since then about it. Over two separate nights, but yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. Check out the characters, they're pretty neat. Anyways, let's get on to today's show, because we're almost at the 5-minute mark and we never want to cross that bridge. What is today's show about, Aaron? The one that Del is so excited about.
Today's
about the show. No, I'm not excited about the show.
Wait, what are you excited about then?
I'm excited about what I'm excited about later in the show.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, tell us about the show that Dell's not necessarily excited about, only tangentially excited about, Aaron.
This is about industry trends, where the industry is going as of September 1st, 2015, when we're recording this.
Yeah.
Where is the tabletop game industry going? What are the trends that we have recognized? Where might they take us?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a weird topic. Hopefully, it's just going to be, you know, a candid conversation by all three of us sort of participating in where we think, what our gut tells us is going on with the state of the gaming industry. And we're going to start off with a very interesting point that Aaron came up with, and I didn't actually think about this until I saw the show notes. But what was your first talking point, Aaron?
My first talking point is that now, when companies make games, very often they are looking to establish that game as a brand.
Right.
Very rarely are you seeing, except, you know, with the exception of some Euro games, you're very rarely seeing, like, I make this game and it's its own single product and I'm done with it and I move on to the next one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ways to do it, but it even works when they aren't the same. For instance, Trains came out and then they realized that they could market Planes by using kind of the same font and making it like a sister game, even though they're different designers and aren't that familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Automobiles will also be coming out as the third. Yes. Yeah.
That doesn't rhyme. I don't get
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah. Doesn't rhyme. Isn't that the whole thing? You're supposed to make them like, that's why Planes and Trains and, like, I don't know, Complains or something.
I think Complains is you right now.
Oh, I am. I am complaining that their lack of rhyming. So I have no idea why those three things are
interrelated. It's an AABA rhyming scheme. You got to wait for the fourth game.
Okay. All right. That I'm okay with that. As a poetry fan, I'm okay with that.
Planes, Trains, Automobiles, and Cranes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Man, I'm in for the building.
Yeah, Cranes actually sounds like the funnest out of all of these.
I was thinking like the bird, but
Maybe it's about both.
Oh. Yeah. A little too
cranes fun. Operating cranes.
Yeah, on one side of the game it's like crane cards, and then you flip the cards over and they're cranes. It's two completely separate games, but they just have the same name.
Yeah, I like it.
This is great. I don't know why they don't hire us. But anyways, to get back to the point about branding, I think you see it a lot in a lot of these like more popular games. Like, for example, Love Letter. They just showed off the really cool new Adventure Time Love Letter kit, which I'll put in the show notes, but you gotta check it out. It looks really, really awesome. And Jake the dog is...
The bag.
Is the bag. Yeah, he looks great. So it's kind of like they're going for a larger audience with some of these brands. You know, you have a million different versions of Flux, a million different versions of Munchkin.
And now Munchkin has infected other games.
Yeah, it's gone into other games. Catan has a ton of different variations of Catan. Why do you think that is, Dell?
It's because people want more of that.
Yeah.
People play one fun thing and they go, oh, I liked this thing. I will like the other thing that is just like it, only with a different thing on it. Companies want people to more easily adopt their product, especially when you have a very niche or specific product like this.
Mm-hmm.
So they're gonna do everything they can to make it easier for people to go from one to the next and have that sort of vertical integration in it.
Yeah.
Where, oh, you like Munchkin? Well, you'll like Munchkin Panic. It's another Castle Panic or Dead Panic type game, but it's got the Munchkin IP stapled onto it, so it's not weird.
Munchkin, if you ever watched that old Brian Regan stand-up, Munchkin is the Cranberries of games. They're just like in everything. You got Munchkin. You ever see that?
No.
It's like Cran Apple, Cran Grapes.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The marketing guy in Cranberries is doing great.
Yeah.
The marketing guy, Steve Jackson, is doing great putting Munchkin in everything. Because you have Munchkin Panic, Munchkin Love Letter, you have Munchkin Smash Up was debuted at Gen Con, and Munchkin Gloom was announced shortly thereafter. So they've basically cross-pollinated with every other popular game they could. I'm waiting for Munchkin Takanoko.
That would be good.
I'm waiting for Munchkin Munchkin.
Munchkin Munchkin would be awesome. I hope they do that. I hope they have enough sort of...
I want to play a game of Munchkin where the different heroes are other games of Munchkin.
Yeah, that'd be great. I think, though, that there's like two varieties of this. One is the Munchkin variety, and I think that Dell hit on it, where people who are fans of Munchkin want more of that thing. I think the Love Letter brand is a little bit different, though, because to me, the Love Letter brand is trying to say we have this great game that we can, you know, put a ton of different IPs on top of, and you might get a fan of Adventure Time who's never played Love Letter to pick up Adventure Time Love Letter because it's a game in the Adventure Time world. Do you think that part of that is a symptom of games just becoming sort of more popular in general and sort of seeping into popular culture?
Yes, but I think that you're right in that it's approached differently. So I think that the idea a lot of times when making a game now is, if this is a hit, I want to really easily be able to leverage it into more hits like it because I like making games like this. And that's why you get worlds like Mice and Mystics, where the world is the brand and they can make tail feathers, or you get a Crossroads game or the Adventure Card Game or Living Card Game, where the mechanic is the brand and you can extend it into other things and just make people go like, oh, I want to play that because I like the other game of that.
I think the mechanic as brand is a little different than the reskins that you see from like the Munchkins and the Love Letters and the Fluxes, where when it's the mechanic as the brand, that's more like saying, you know, oh, we're going to go to the movies. We're going to see, oh, it's one of the Shaw Brothers movies. And, you know, the Shaw Brothers are legendary importers, dubbers of 70s kung fu movies, mm-hmm. where just Shaw Brothers became the brand. It was a different director, different actors in each one, but that when you saw a Shaw Brothers movie, you knew it was going to be awesome chop-socky kung fu. And that sort of thing, when you say, oh, it's a Crossroads game, you are attracting not people interested in the IP, not people interested in the paint on the top, but the actual mechanics of the game. Whereas the Adventure Time Love Letter is going to appeal to Adventure Time fans more than it's going to appeal to Love Letter fans. Whereas the Master of the Flying Guillotine Crossroads game is going to appeal to people who've played other Crossroads games rather than whatever IP is on the top of it.
Is this phenomenon associated with larger publishers in general? Is this something that like your Fantasy Flight or your Cryptozoics or your Z-Man, are these the people that are doing this type of thing, or is it across the board?
On some level, it's across the board, because the one as brand we didn't mention at all here is the designer as brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so with all of these for like design and designer / publishers that work in-house largely, like Stonemaier, for example, those games aren't all in the same world or share the same mechanic, but because Jamie Stonemaier and Alan Stone make them, people want them. Right. So like everyone does it to an extent. As far as the like extreme end of it, like the Munchkin end of it, or the Love Letter end of it, I think that that's largely the purview of big publishers. And it's good in a way because it allows them to always have a safe stream of income that funds the more outrageous things they do.
Yeah.
Which is good, because while I don't think anyone at this table needs to own multiple versions of Munchkin, or I don't think Munchkin Gloom is really being advertised to us, it does allow AEG to make like kind of the weird Euros that they do put out from time to time.
Yeah, I think the relation that Dell had to cinema, I think, applies in a lot of situations in regards to this. And it's sort of like Robert Rodriguez, you know, he kept cranking out Spy Kids sequels because those gave him the money to make the movies that he wanted to make. And that's what kind of the what you're describing, Aaron. But it is a little bit akin to it as well, in the fact that you do have designers who make a wide variety of games, and those are sort of like directors, where, you know, Quentin Tarantino movies all have his sort of style to them, but they're not necessarily telling one coherent story. He does make some sequels, but for the most part, they're all in different worlds, different universes. And then you get the games that are just purely the sequels. And I think that Kickstarter didn't necessarily spur this on, but you see it a lot on Kickstarter. We're going to talk about Kickstarter later in the show. But I think that a lot of times when a designer nowadays is going into the game design business, and you realize that publishing games, it's a growing industry, but it's still not making a lot of millionaires. It's still not making a lot of people, you know, annual incomes that can pay all of their bills, to be honest. You have that kind of Hollywood mindset where I want to make something that I can then make expansions for. So, because if this thing is possible, I can keep raking in that money a little bit and keep that train going. Do you think that's fair, Aaron?
Yes. I will say that this has a downside, though. It's mm-hmm. not all good that this is happening because we don't know where it is, but there is a Munchkin saturation point. There is a point where people who are playing all these Munchkin games go, I don't need another Munchkin. You know, there's most people grow out of the cartoons they like when they're young. Most people grow out of their interests and things change. And if a company spends all its time doing these crossovers and rebrandings and all that and not making new, innovative, interesting games, in the long run, if it continues, there are downsides potentially there for the hobby as a whole when big publishers stop producing new and interesting things for the sake of the easy buck.
Same complaint people might have about Hollywood too. The fact that, you know, every movie that comes out is basically a remake or a sequel of something that's already been out.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the saturation point, I think that is something interesting to think about because, you know, I don't know how it is at Card Kingdom. Maybe you can divulge a little bit. How many of the base sets of Munchkin do you sell? Do they still move off the shelf? Do they fly off the shelf?
Yep, they still sell pretty well. I'm always amazed that... I always say, like, I'm kind of amazed that the people who... There are still people who want Cards Against Humanity, Munchkin, and Catan who don't own Cards Against Humanity, Munchkin, and Catan.
Yeah.
Because we sell a lot of them every year. They have new audiences. So, like I said, we're not at the saturation point yet, but the dangerous thing about market saturation is it's really difficult to see coming. It just right. happens. And then... It's a bad thing for all the people involved. So
yeah, I mean, I think that like games like the ones you mentioned, Cards Against Humanity, Munchkin, Catan, those are gateway games. Those are things that like anyone can sort of get into relatively quickly. And so I think that, you know, having those on the shelves at Target is a great thing. I think that the saturation point is probably a lot larger than something like, you know, an expansion for, I don't know, Terra Mystica, for example, right? That's like getting... They can't keep cranking out expansions for this very, very niche product. But for the larger ones, maybe they can get away with it. Now, that does lead to another type of thing, and I guess this all relates to the Hollywood aspect as well, is that there's another type of branding that's going on with board games. And, Del, why don't you speak to that a little bit?
So, we touched on this in the first segment, but licenses... matter. IP matters. The coat of paint, so to speak, over the actual rule set is actually getting important and relevant. No more, you know, X-opoly. Mm-hmm. It's actually real games that are getting a coat of paint on them that is attractive to the mainstream. You know, for instance, Gale Force 9 doing Spartacus and Sons of Anarchy. That WWE game that Bebo is super jazzed about, that I am also super jazzed about. Like,
yeah.
I remember very clearly back in the 80s and 90s, there were all the tie-in games, and they were just straight up roll your dice, move your mice, really just bad games. And if you were lucky, it was like Stratego with G.I. Joe and Cobra Commander. Like, that was the best bet, was just a reskin of a classic game.
Yeah.
And now these games are good.
Yeah, Upper Deck arguably has had more success with their Encounter series for Legendary than anything else. They did Alien last year. They did Predator at Gen Con. There's talk of Big Trouble in Little China coming out as a Legendary Encounters game.
What?
Yeah, there's a lot of... So Terminator is in apparently in the pipeline, as well as possibly Big Trouble in Little China,
yeah.
The deck-building game, essentially.
And in fairness, you know, we oftentimes will forget the fact that, you know, comic books are also licensed IPs.
Yeah,
you
know? And so this... I think that it's awesome. Minis have been hopping on the IP bandwagon. There is a Batman miniatures game of well-made, unpainted like miniatures.
So not just Batman HeroClix.
No, like Batman the miniatures game is made by Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the rules. It looks really cool because everything is assumed to happen in the dark except for streetlights that are the most important terrain you place down. And then you do skirmish warfare, and you can have like Batman and Nightwing as your crew, or you can have like Bane and a group of thugs Bugs as your crew, and they have all the different Batmans. You can run Adam West 66 Batman if you want.
That sounds awesome.
And it looks cool. The minis are great. You know, before, same thing with Mars Attacks, that had a real minis game made for it.
Now, on that Batman minis game, are they just using the Infinity rules, or?
Nope, it's their own game. It's its own rules. It's built to model the fights that happen in Batman, so it's...
That's great.
It's built to do that, and that's kind of indicative of how people approach licenses now. It's not just, can I staple this license on these mechanics? It's, how do I bring out the license with these mechanics?
Right.
Do you think that's because more of the smaller companies, more of like, because if Gale Force 9 that did, you know, the WWE and the Firefly game, but if Milton Bradley did the WWE game, it would be terrible.
I don't know if that's quite fair, but I do see your point, though. I think more it's just that the idea of a hobby game, the idea of you know, what games are, is changing. So you can't really come out with a WWE game and that is, you know, WWE Monopoly, where you're going around and collecting different wrestlers to put into your stable to, like, build hotels on or whatever.
Although that actually sounds like a pretty decent analog.
I would like to
a wrestling.
Yeah, I would like to revisit our Monopoly bullet points,
but,
and change my answer.
I actually think, quite frankly, the reason that this has become a thing is because at some point somebody looked at how many copies Battlestar Galactica sold,
yeah,
and then they were like, "Oh, wait. If you do this, you make money." I think Fantasy Flight took that gamble largely. And there were others around the time, you know, Cryptozoic, before, when they were just an arm of Blizzard, was making all the Blizzard board games, and they had some level of success, but not quite as much. But I think Battlestar Galactica is the point where people went, oh, if you really put the theme in the mechanics, the fans will all buy this game, but they'll stick around because it's actually good.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened. And that's why you see now, you know, even a studio like Plaid Hat tried a licensed game with the BioShock Infinite board game.
Yeah, I think Battlestar is a great example, because it also sort of it's a thing that you can't really tell what happened first. It's like a chicken or the egg type of scenario, where at some point someone decided that they're going to take an IP and actually build a great game for that IP, like Battlestar Galactica. And so now you have a whole generation of gamers who may not have any ties to the Battlestar IP, especially now that the show's been, you know, off the air for a while now. But Battlestar Galactica is still a phenomenal game, and gamers like it, and fans of Battlestar Galactica see a Battlestar Galactica game and try it out. And I think that once you start bridging that gap and you realize that, hey, we can actually hit a larger audience if we make a good game that has an IP attached to it, you can get a lot more people involved in it. I think that's a plus. And then also the aside that I think hobby games are getting larger and larger as we're going through. What do you think is going to be the next big swath of IPs that are coming in to gaming, Aaron? Where do you see that coming from?
Well, I think that RPGs have led the way with IPs for a long time. Like, there's been Star Trek, Star Wars,
Marvel Superheroes,
Street RPGs
Fighter.
Yeah, I love that
for a long time. Like, they, long before board games were really, you know, being successful with IPs.
Before
RPGs
board games
were.
Existed. Before the concept of a board existed.
I don't know about that. There are some pretty old board games, but before board games were having hits there, and minis games were even thinking of going there, RPGs have had success with licenses. And I think if you want to, like, look to where it's going, you can see that people are having success with more and more niche licenses, because if the games are good, it doesn't matter. So RPGs are tapping into things like Atomic Robo, like kind of a niche comic, or Rat Queens, Matt Forbeck's Shotguns and Sorcery novels, the Mistborn novels that Brandon Sanderson writes. You're finding these more and more niche. It's not just the Fireflies and Star Treks that are getting licensed. And I think that board games will follow suit, and they already have, because IDW put out a Chew, which is one of the comics they do, board game, and they also put out a Kill Shakespeare board game, which is based on their comics. So you're already seeing more obscure licenses starting to be used to leverage more niche fan bases into starting the sales of an item. As long as the game is good, it won't matter.
Yeah, and I think it's a great thing for independent artists who are creating content. Like, you know, if you're an independent company making, you know, a comic book, as someone who, you know, is relatively close to, like, you know, the independent sphere, I think it's, you're always looking for another revenue stream. And if you can get into games, you can get more merch in, you know, on your site, that's a good thing. And games are, you know, if games are willing to welcome you with open arms, then I think it can be a great, great thing. So in general, our stance on brands in board games and RPGs moving forward, like, how do you want to sum up this, our feelings on this, Aaron? I'll give you a chance to sum it up in a sentence or two.
I think that, as far as I go, I support building a brand with everything you do, and I support making great games out of licenses. I would be careful about just haphazardly slapping that brand on literally everything that comes out, because personally it doesn't interest me, and I don't think I'm alone here at the table.
So in other words, the state of the union is strong.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Good. That's all I wanted to hear. I feel strengthened by that, actually. We touched on it a little bit, so let's get on to the next sort of big thing in board games. And in fact, in fairness, this is probably the biggest thing happening to board games right now. And RPGs, I guess.
And
also.
Games.
And games in general. That's true. I just had PAX this weekend. It's very, very evident that this is also changing video games as well. And what is that, Dell?
That is funding via the crowd.
Yes.
And I was trying to localize this, so I don't mean like, hey, it's the new thing, crowdfunding. This was more of like where crowdfunding is at right now.
Yeah. No, I think so. And I think that crowdfunding is driving the games industry across the board. In relation to board games and RPGs, you're talking specifically, almost exclusively about Kickstarter, because Kickstarter and board games, if you ever listen to, there's a show called Funding the Dream. It's about Kickstarter, but it's mostly about board game Kickstarters. And they talk about it, how Kickstarter and the board game industry sort of latched onto each other early, and then both, you know, piggybacked off each other moving forward. So Kickstarter at this point still is like the de facto board game and RPG source for crowdfunding. That's changing a little bit. Even companies like Hasbro are starting to partner with companies like Indiegogo, for example. And
which I strongly disagree with.
We'll talk about that in a second. But right now, Hasbro and Indiegogo announced that they're going to be doing a design challenge for games. They're going to take the top five designs they get. They're all going to get, you know, Indiegogo campaigns, and then the winner gets like $10,000 and their game produced by Hasbro or whatever. Because I think the Indiegogo is trying to get itself into the mindset of games, and I think Hasbro is trying to glean a little bit of that shine off of hobby games in general.
Let's be honest, Hasbro is desperately trying to find another product that makes them money besides Magic.
Yeah, I mean, they're a company,
yeah.
So they're going to be doing that.
They are doing very poorly aside from Magic, and that's well known.
Yeah.
They're looking for anything that will be another Magic for them.
Right. I'm looking for a Magic for me.
Oh, sure.
Any company is going to be wanting to increase its revenue stream. And Hasbro is looking at indie games and saying, these are doing well. Hobby games are doing very well. Let's make more money. So let's talk a little bit about the state of crowdfunding. Dell, you said that you're against big guys like Hasbro taking advantage of this.
Yeah.
Why don't you sum that up and we'll start there.
So the point of crowdfunding is to give the quirky, idiosyncratic, non-mainstream games a chance. It's the place where Tim Schafer can go ahead and get $1 million to make, you know, Broken Age because people want more Monkey Island. It's not the place for someone like Atari to be like, yeah, we want to make GTA 5. Does anyone want to buy that? Why don't you give us money ahead of time so we can bankroll it off of your backs? Mm-hmm. If you are a major company and you have the resources to actually fund something and then release a finished product, that should be on you. You can't put that on the backs of normal consumers when you do have traditional funding and research and development coffers.
Where's the line though? Because like I could see almost any company benefiting from crowdfunding in tabletop, because I don't think any of them, with the exception of Asmodee, Wizards of the Coast, and, you know, I mean, Hasbro is Wizards of the Coast at this point, so you know, except for like those two guys, I think that almost anyone, it would be fair to for them to crowdfund, because there's almost no reason not to. You know, some people don't like to because managing the thing is not a thing they want to do, like Stronghold Games.
Yeah, Stronghold Games, you know, they did one game, they crowdfunded it. It was successful, very successful. And Stephen Bunnicker was like, you know what? Like, I'm not going to do it. It was a lot of work. I can fund my games, you know, myself and do the things the way I've always done it. And I prefer that method. I'm going to go that route.
And but they do their own pre-order system, right, which they've kind of, I think they kind of implemented after watching how everyone uses Kickstarter.
Sure.
And that allows them to do that. But
even companies like, you know, Plaid Hat doesn't do Kickstarter, but they do pre-order systems. However, I do want to say that there's also game companies, though, that have came out and said, you know what, like, crowdfunding works for us, and we're probably never not going to do crowdfunding because it works for us.
I think it depends on the product. I think if you're making a mainstream sold in big box stores product, if you're making, you know, a Monopoly variant, you have no business crowdfunding. If you're making a super, super dense Euro that nobody can comprehend except Aaron and has three different wooden cubes of
three.
Different...
Only
yeah,
three.
Yeah, three different kinds, just cubes. And then there's also many different polyhedrons going on top of it.
I'm interested in this game. Yeah.
Just
great,
cubes of different sizes as well. You know, if you have a super niche product, Kickstarter is great for helping you find the audience to make that take off. Mm-hmm. But if you are making a mainstream product, you probably shouldn't be forcing people to fund your R&D and then deliver.
Define forcing people to fund.
Because if you don't fund it, the product won't exist, apparently.
Right. I think that, like, that's hard to say. Like, if to the people who are funding, what is this, WWE Monopoly, you know, they are, if they're fine with that transaction and they're fine giving Hasbro money to make this thing that they want and then they receive that thing.
See, but they're under no obligation to receive that thing is the risk. If Kickstarter would straight up say, this is
now.
A pre-order, if they said this is a pre-order and you get it when it's made or you get your money back, that's fine. But Kickstarter, you're assuming all of the risks of the investor, mm-hmm, with none of the guarantees of there will be a finished product.
Okay,
and that's a risk that everyone has to balance with how badly they want this niche product.
I will agree with most of that. I will agree with you that maybe, you know, non-niche products. Unfortunately, the entire tabletop industry is niche at this point. It's not mainstream. So it doesn't matter. Anyone could really have business in the market and kickstarting. But the other thing you said is very important, because I think that people are much warier with their kickstarting now than they were in 2010 or 2011. I think that overall they're just, you know, if somebody doesn't have a project under their belt already, people are very leery of giving that project money,
right,
unless they already have a following or something going there. You can't just put a good idea on Kickstarter and have it succeed. You have to think about marketing ahead of time. You have to think about what it looks like. You have to be so much farther in the development cycle of the product now before people are going to give it a chance.
And I think that is part of the catch-22 that exists with crowdfunding. Because the fact of the matter is if I have an idea for this very, very complex Euro game with a bajillion components and different types of wood, different types of meeples, different types of anything, and it's very, very niche, traditionally, if I wanted to get that made, I would have to get investors, convince people that it's an item that will sell, get the money together, and make it, and put the risk on myself. Now I'm giving that risk to someone else. And that is a very, very scary proposition. Like Dell said, those people could get burned on that. Now, you get large companies like, I would say at this point, Cool Mini or not, who puts a Kickstarter out for nearly every game they do. I think every game they do.
I don't know if the Grizzled had one, but everything else I can think of
so
has
for,
one.
For most of the things they do, at least. They've been using Kickstarter consistently. They've been actually delivering on, you know, their promises for the most part. And so it's that catch-22 where it's, you know, if you want the small, if you want a place for the small guy to get their dream made, then you have Kickstarter. But the downside to that is that person is not an expert in the field. A lot of times they're a first-time publisher. A lot of times they're a first-time designer. And then you have that kind of that imbalance there where the large companies that know what they're doing, some people are saying, should not be using crowdfunding in the first place. So to me, I think that it's definitely something that people have to sort of take and look at from a few different angles. And I know that I get a lot of flack on this show for being that type of person. But the way I see it is, listen, I know what Kickstarter was originally. I remember when Kickstarter first began, and you actually, I knew it from the music angle. And in order to set up a campaign on Kickstarter, you had to get an invite from someone else who had set up a campaign. So if I get a campaign on there, I get like three invites, and it was very, very exclusive group of people, and it was all sort of curated by the artistic communities that were using it at the time, which was a cool thing. But it's grown since then, and it's changed since then. And yes, I think some companies use it as a pre-order system. Some companies use it to fund things that they otherwise couldn't make. And you're going to have both of those. And I think that you can't, it's very, very difficult to say to one side of those people that this is not what, you know, you should be using this for, when both sides are seeing some success from it.
Yeah, I think that Kickstarter overall is a really great force because it allows these weirder things to get made, especially in RPGs. Like, lots of cool stuff sees the light of day that would never have seen the light of day before. Ross Kalman, who I played with at Go Play Northwest, did the Fall of Magic game that's actually on a canvas scroll that you unroll as the game plays. Like, that's never getting made without Kickstarter. Nobody's giving that thousands of dollars so that he can produce it. And if you're a gamer like most of us here, at least me and Chris, probably less so Dell, and you want to play some meatier stuff from time to time, Kickstarter is really good because the rest of the market has definitely moved towards gateway games, party games, and co-ops. That's where a lot of the big publishers put a lot of their money because it's what makes them the most money. Kickstarter is almost the opposite. Like, there are party games and gateway games on there, but a lot of the big successes are these Cool Mini or Not games, which are pretty intricate Ameritrashy games, or these like deep Euros like Mare Nostrum that made $250,000 on a concept that's like an incredibly dense, exploration game.
Was Terra Mystica a Kickstarter?
No, but I was going to say that, you know, there is an exception in things that are brought over from the German market.
Mm-hmm. Actual but, Euro games.
Yeah, like actual Euros from Essen still get brought over. But overall, you know, a lot of the money, they get smaller print runs and the big money goes to the lighter fare. And so Kickstarter is kind of a haven for a lot of the explorations of heavier, meatier games, and I think that's cool. So I'm really glad that Kickstarter exists. There was a time when I was very critical. I think the moment where I had to stop and think was when the Zombicide second wave Kickstarter went up, because I was like, you guys made like so much money. How can you not afford to do this? And then I realized like Kickstarter also doubles as marketing and all this stuff you'd have to pay money for. And I want designers to get paid. So kickstarting is great on that. Like, that model is a lot better once you've got it down for actually paying creators of games. So
yeah, I mean, there's definitely things I'm critical about with Kickstarter. For example, I think that the designer publisher relationships need to adjust for the post Kickstarter era that we're in, or I guess the Kickstarter era that we're in, because I think that a lot of times designers, when it comes to contracts, get screwed a little bit because people are giving them, royalties based off of this old model where the publisher was actually taking on the financial risk of a project. I think now that most of that financial risk is put into backers of the project specifically, that designers should see a larger cut of those profits because, no longer is the publisher, taking on so much risk in order to do that. However, at the end of the day, I think Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general is a tool that people are going to use it for, whatever it works for, right? Like, if you can't find a bottle opener, you're going to use a claw hammer to open a bottle. I just made that up, but I could see you. I could see you doing that.
The last word I have is that the real risk to Kickstarter is that Kickstarter management themselves have very perverse incentives, because they make their 10% or 8% off the top, no matter what the product is and whether or not it delivers.
Right.
So the curation that they should be doing of saying, is this a complete joke? Is this a fraud? Is this person just going to run off with everyone's money and tarnish our brand? Is tempered by, we just made, $60,000 off the guy who got $600,000 to do, I'm going to make potato salad.
Yeah.
So their curation is perversely incentivized.
Although he did deliver.
He did. He had a huge potato salad party.
Yeah.
Kickstarter success story.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, and would I like to see more consumer protection? Absolutely, yes. 100%. Because you know, people should know going into it that that there's risks involved with Kickstarter. But in fairness, you should read your iTunes EULA, and you don't. You just click accept and you move on, you download iTunes, right? So I think that Kickstarter does have room to grow, and it will. I think it will adapt to, you know, what it's being used for. But at the end of the day, I think that it's a great thing for board games, and it definitely allows more games to hit the market. It democratizes the design process and gives a lot of people a chance to make something that otherwise would not have that chance, which is really, really cool. So the state of Kickstarter is strong.
You on the next bullet point?
Yeah, go ahead, Aaron. What is the next bullet point on our discussion?
So Edition Wars and like brand name, while there are more and more brands, the idea of this brand loyalty warrior is fading. And you might not always get this when you look at the internet, because that's the very vocal minority is on the internet. Yeah. But in actuality,
that's not fair. Everyone's on the internet now.
Sure, but not everyone, you know,
not everyone is vocal.
Not everyone is that vocal on the internet. Not everyone hangs out on message boards for the things they love.
Or the things they hate.
True. And in the minis and RPG space especially, this has been a problem in the past, where people think that the one game they play is the only game you could play. You know, there were for a lot of Games Workshop fans who, when Warmer Horde started to come out and get any sense of market share, they would, you know, just mock it and call it stupid and vice versa, that, you know, and you could only play like one game in any space at a time. There are people who played D&D and hated on World of Darkness and all that. And that's kind of going away, and more people are owning more and more games. As there's less and less just kind of dabbling in this, in the tabletop industry. It's very rare to meet someone who only plays Warmer Hordes and doesn't also have
Armada.
An Infinity Troop or Armada or X-Wing. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare to meet somebody who feels quite so strongly now that 5e has kind of quelled the furor that came out with the 4e debacle. You know, the Pathfinder and D&D players aren't yelling insults across the room at each other at your local RPG night anymore, because the ground between them has kind of narrowed. Some companies deal with this change in market better than others. Games Workshop is not doing quite, they haven't quite figured out that there's a lot more people in their market space. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, companies like Weird are super psyched to get into this market and are thriving because of it.
I saw a really great tweet.
I was about to say.
Yeah, ahead. I saw a really great tweet from Privateer Press. A guy posted that he sent a drunk email. He's like, one of the sprues on his Weird figure was busted. Mm-hmm. So he sent an email, but he sent it to Privateer Press because he also plays Warma Hordes. He's like, you broke the sprue on my Neverborn.
I'm missing this piece.
Yeah, and... And Privateer was like, yeah, Weird, that's not our game, but here's a Crix battle box.
Yeah, it's sent
that's
to
pretty great.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's and awesome. That's and that's because that dude plays through Malifaux and, you know, War Machine, and Privateer is smart enough to realize that there is enough joy to play two games. And right. I think even at Card Kingdom, Malifaux is Thursdays, War Machine is Wednesdays, so you can easily play both.
I mean, yeah. I'm not going to name them because I don't know if it's a thing that they would get in trouble for, but I've watched Privateer Press players playing Warhammer 40K in our store before. Like they're pretty open and honest that they play each other's games. Companies realize that they don't have to be like cutthroat, you know, attacking each other, or most of them realize this, and that instead they just can basically cross-promote all day and tell you that everything in the space is awesome unless it's, you know, actually harmful.
You know, it's really that territorialism is very interesting, because usually the creators, it's not stemming from them. It's stemming from the fan bases. We are blessed to be in the Northwest, where we have tons of game designers and game companies that are in the area. And I can tell you, I know a lot of employees at places like Paizo, places like Privateer Press, places like Wizards of the Coast. They all play tons of games. There's a Wizards employee who I was talking to at Gen Con, actually, about Ashes. Because he was like, oh, he makes Magic the Gathering, and he was like really interested in like the mechanics of Ashes and how it worked, and he wanted me to sell him on it, basically. So I think like from the creatives that create these products, I think a lot of that stuff has been for a long time not really an issue between them, but you still for a long time we're getting it between fandoms. One of the most, I mean, this is not games, and we're getting off on a little tangent here, but that's okay. This episode can do that. One of the most egregious things I saw was today was a thing by Burger King. I don't know if you guys check this out. It was on social media. There is like a charity called One Day Peace or Peace One Day or something like that. September 21st, Burger King has a pop-up restaurant that they're putting up. And they've reached out to McDonald's, Denny's, all these other companies. But they reached out to McDonald's first and they said, hey, we want to make a Big Mac Whopper. Combine forces, make a sandwich and sell it at this pop-up stand to benefit this charity. McDonald's hasn't answered them, but like Denny's and all these other companies responded and said, we want in on that. And so now the new thing is they're like, okay, we're going to take one of our signature ingredients from all of our companies and make this like burger that we're going to sell on this one day to benefit charity. And it's like, obviously it's a great, you know, great marketing ploy from Burger King, because why not? But I mean, if McDonald's and Burger King can get along, like, the world
it kind of warms my heart, yeah, this story in a weird way, like, yeah, which is weird. It's like brand on brand action, like, yeah, yay, which is not how I normally feel about that,
yeah, but it is what it is.
Yeah, I think that it's starting to trickle down. The fans are getting like, oh yeah, the people who make this stuff don't care like we do about this, so maybe we're being ridiculous. And you know, it's starting to catch on, and people, I've had a lot more people like ask me questions. I had a person who just a few weeks ago told me they would never play the Final Fantasy or the Fantasy, they would never play the Fantasy Flight Star Wars games because funny dice, you know, they didn't like it and they were D20 only, until one day I explained to them how the non-binary resolution often means that circumstance can drive plot in weird directions, and that's actually kind of the foundation of Star Wars. Stuff happens all the time and the characters react to it. It's about the Force. It's about the universe as a character. It acts and they have to respond. And then like they looked at me all like, damn you, Aaron, why did you have to make me interested in this thing I hated 30 seconds ago? And I think there's a lot more of that. Like a lot of, at least gamers who have been in the, you know, in the hobby a while, starting to kind of ungrinch themselves and try new things.
You know, I think that
part of that is really just there's a lot more great games than there were back in the 80s and 90s. There weren't a lot of great games. Mm-hmm. There were still games, but it was a lot more amateurish for a lot of products that weren't top flight products.
Oh, and, yeah, our end of the list this year is going to be so hard this year.
Where now it is, you know, publishing software has gotten cheap enough, and print on demand and PDF publishing has gotten cheap enough that people can actually be good at making games. And there's some really revolutionary stuff that's come out and been fantastic, yeah, which ungrinches people really fast, because when there's choice between one or two games, and now there's, you know, a billion games tailored to every level of enjoyment and crunchiness.
Right, and I think the combination with that and the fact that I think our hobby is both growing and maturing. I think that people like myself, who I think I talked about this somewhere, but when I was like in third grade, I played GURPS. And there's another group in my class, my third grade, like honors class or whatever, third grade honors, whatever. But anyways,
I wasn't going to say anything. I'm glad you called yourself out.
No doubt. But they played D&D, and there was like beef between us, like third grade, like edition war. I was like, man, GURPS is like way cooler. I could be in space or fantasy, you jerks, or whatever I called them.
And then they're like, Spelljammer.
Yeah, but then I, yeah, exactly. But then I realized, though,
one of them said it just like, yeah, that.
Spelljammer. Yeah. But then, you know, as you get older, you realize that, hey, like, I can have fun doing what I like, and other people can have fun doing what they like, and, you know, it's okay. And if we want to, our hobby to be, you know, inclusive, we need to embrace the fact that, you know, people are going to be into it for different reasons, and not like shun them or make fun of them before they even get their foot in the door, really, you know?
Agreed.
So there you go. State of that in games. What is that? What are we calling that? That's the state of brand wars in games.
Sure.
Aaron, what is it?
We'll just call it the end of edition wars and brand wars.
So brand wars is...
Let us usher in a new era of peace and harmony.
Sure.
McWhopper. All right. Anyways, the last point, again, alludes to something that Dell was talking about. And he was, and we talked about it with Kickstarter as well, like this democratization of game design and the fact that people can now do, you know, bigger, crazier, more beautiful things than they ever did before. But that's leading to another trend, Aaron. And what is that trend?
You can't make ugly games anymore.
Can't.
Yeah. Cannot. If you're not, the only person I can think of, and they're not ugly, they're just more plain, is Asmodee and GMT make some kind of plain-looking games because they're all about mechanics on those games. But that's really it. Other than that, every game has to be pretty now, or it doesn't sell. You can't release an ugly Euro with a smug white guy on the cover and have a hit without it being a really good-looking.
I'm a duke standing in front of a field.
Yeah, you have
That's
to,
not $45 anymore. You can't just be like, yep, I'm... Paying $45 for that? Nope.
You have to dig deeper. You have to find a real artist, a real layout person. You know, get real good
Your
graphic
charts
design.
Have to line up.
Yeah, no. It has to. The level of quality that's demanded by the consumer is higher, and board games are more expensive for it. The
RPGs
average price,
too.
Yeah, the average price of everything is going up. But I can't really complain when everything on my shelf is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm not crying about Fantasy Flight games because, oh my God, those Star Wars books.
Yeah, the stuff they make is amazing looking. So it, you know, and that helps show it's worth paying for quality. And games have moved in that direction. So
how is James Ernst doing nowadays? Because his whole shtick was. Very cheaply
it was,
made.
But it was not anymore.
But now he is taking a combination of new ideas and taking a lot of the very popular cheap ass games and giving them the full treatment, thanks to Kickstarter.
Yeah,
he's very active on Kickstarter. His next thing is a new edition, a 10th anniversary edition of Kill Dr. Lucky with like full art and color and like, you know, really well made. So
that's one of the other things that I want to mention with the Kickstarter thing is it's like people look at James Ernst and say, well, you've been making games for, you know, 20 years now. Like, why do you need Kickstarter? Did you look at the difference between the games he made then and made now? Like, that's why you need
Kickstarter. Then it was a sheet of paper and a thing saying cannibalized components from your game of Sorry.
That doesn't count. You can't say, oh, you've been making games this whole time. No, he's been making what he could.
He's been making rules for 20 years.
Right.
Now he gets to make actual full games.
Yes. Anyways, along those same lines, though, with, you know, appearance and stuff, I personally think that themes are being required to become more interesting in games as well. I think that no longer can you come out with an RPG that is a fantasy RPG. You need something else there. You need some other hook there. No longer can you come out with a Euro game that is, farming in the Mediterranean.
Neither of those has stopped some of the lower tier publishers, though. There's still fantasy heartbreakers coming out every month.
And there will be, and that's fine. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, Aaron said you cannot do this. Well, of course you can do these things. But we're talking about like your big successes in the games that are really gonna move the meter when it comes to, you know, the hobby that we're in. And the fact of the matter is that you have to do something new, interesting, and it has to be a quality product. And that's just the way things are now.
It's not easy, but it is simple.
I think you use that line in our.
I've used the other one, which is it's simple, but it's not easy.
Oh, it goes both ways.
Yes,
there you go. So, so the state of art direction and theme in board games, Aaron. What's your verdict on it?
It's good.
Okay, excellent. That was great.
The nation is strong.
The nation. There you go.
That's you guys stole that from me.
Stole what from you?
State of our nation strong.
You stole that from presidents.
Yeah, it's not like you have it. It's not like yours. You're like, I always say this thing that popular franchise X says. Like, that doesn't always.
The agree. Thing that is broadcast on every channel in like, the entire.
It's like if you ended every podcast saying "I'll be back," and then one day I said "I'll be back," and you were mad about it. Like, I always rip off Terminator.
It's my thing. Anyways, so that is our take. On the industry as a whole, We felt that we've been doing the show for a long time. In fact, our very first episode we ever recorded, episode zero, has never been released, but it was actually about Kickstarter. And so we're glad to bring our perspective and our take on the way things are going right now. But we'd love to hear yours as well. Tell us if we're off base. Tell us where we went wrong or what we got right or what we're missing when it comes to trends in board games and role-playing games. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us on social media. My Twitter handle is at NPCChris. Del?
At NPCDEL.
Aaron?
At NPC Aaron.
If you want to tweet at the whole gang, you can do that by going to at NPCcast on Twitter. We have an email address as well. And what is that email address, Del?
It is thenpccast@gmail.com.
It sure is. And of course, we're on Facebook too. What is the Facebook URL, Aaron?
Facebook.com/NPCcast.
It sure is. And like I said at the top of the show, if you feel so inclined, you can donate to us at patreon.com/NPCcast. All donations are very, very appreciated. We thank you so much if you're already a backer of the show for letting us do this really cool thing each and every week. But we're not done yet with today's show. We're going to tell you the things that we're excited about, and we're going to do that right now. So this past weekend, I was at PAX. I got a little bit of the PAX pox, but not too bad. I've been going to a lot of cons recently, so I've been kind of con credited full on for about a month and a half now. Anyways, at PAX, I went to a panel, and this panel was about a game previously called Thornwatch. Not sure if I talked about it on the show before, but Thornwatch is a game that was originally designed by Mike Krahulik, and it is a card-based RPG. The whole design intent is to, as he said, remove all the bullshit from RPGs and make something that was easy to run on the fly. You didn't need anything more than a couple cards or whatever. It has a really cool mechanic based on momentum, where you actually have your initiative is cards that you put out in a row, and then as you're beating up monsters, they're going later and later in initiative until eventually they're knocked off the end of the initiative track and they're removed and you can get treasure and all that kind of stuff. The layout is supposed to be pretty cool. You have your different maps that lay out, and it's laid out kind of like the panels of a comic book, and so you can kind of play on the map itself. It's a tactical card game with, you know, figurines and stuff like that. That was the initial intent. It is based off of one of their comic strips called Thornwatch, which is some of the cooler stuff that I think Penny Arcade's done in, you know, since they've been created, basically. And it's kind of a neat sort of fantasy world that they've created with these Thornwatch people in the woods and whatnot. This concept, though, they have announced that they're expanding. Two things that they did. First of all, they brought on Mike Selinker and Lone Shark Games, who are now actually going to be officially publishing and designing, co-designing this game with Mike Krahulik and the team at Penny Arcade. But Mike Selinker said, hey, we're not going to just do Thornwatch. We want to do all of that universe. And they call it the Ironwood. So they're going to be coming out with Ironwood Adventures. It's going to be a series of games, but it's going to be Thornwatch. Then you have one on the Lookouts, which are basically young boys who go out into the woods to sort of become wardens of the woods, and they earn merit badges and put the merit badges on their scabbards and all that kind of stuff. A lot of them die because they have to fight monsters, you know, like Boy Scouts do. And then, of course, they have the Daughters as well. And the Daughters are young girls who are basically have a calling to the woods, sort of become like druids, and then they go out to the woods and become stewards of one area of the forest. And they're seen as sort of like the apex predators in their little area because it's their job to make sure that things are going good. So this game is actually going to be a series of games that are all going to have kind of pieces that can be bridged together. So you can play with Lookouts and Daughters or Lookouts and Thornwatch in the same game, combine them however you want. Each one is going to bring a different set of mechanics to it. But I'm very, very interested in the game. As you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it. Like I said, the art is pretty awesome. Mike Krahulik said that he's done all the art so far, and I think it's some of the best work he's done, to be honest. But there are other artists, for example, that work on the Lookouts comic book that are going to be evolved eventually.
Wait, there's a Lookouts comic book?
Yeah.
Oh.
Or a Thornwatch comic book. There's a comic book on one of them that's not drawn by him.
Oh, okay. Yeah. How have I never even seen this comic?
I don't know. But anyways, right. So yeah, check it out. It's still sort of in its infancy. They're going through tests and stuff like that, but I'm pretty excited about it. And link to the show notes, you can check it out for yourself. But that's what I'm excited about. Ironwood Adventures. There you go. Boom. Del, what about you?
So my number one movie of the year, and what I think on my show, Pop Culture Playoffs, is going to be, if not the winner, then certainly a finalist, was Mad Max Fury Road.
Okay.
I think it's nearly perfect. and they have just released a Mad Max video game, not tied to Fury Road, just in the Mad Max universe.
Love it.
And you drive around in desolate wastelands, get in car chases and car combat, and then go around fighting people using the Batman Arkham Asylum fighting engine, which is more rhythm and timing based. What's great about video game tie-ins is when it's a tie-in and not a product designed to sync with the movie, they can actually just finish it when it's actually done and release it. Mm-hmm. So the Mad Max game is coming out now, even though Fury Road came out months ago, because it's finally done. What's going to make you want to buy this game is that basically Warner Brothers Interactive said, let's get a team that knows what they're doing. And they went and got Avalanche Studios to put together the Mad Max games. Avalanche Studios is most famous for Just Cause, which is the sort of insane, huge open world, grappling hook, everything, jump off of blimps with parachutes going on, and then spawn a dune buggy in midair and drive it, you know, across this South American island.
Oh yeah, that genre.
Yeah. It's also Just Cause 2 was the other game in that genre.
Yeah, two games in that genre, actually.
Yeah, so when you're talking about video games where you want to make exploring the world fun and moving through it interesting, Avalanche Games, Just Cause, and they're the ones who made Mad Max. It is fantastic, and if you get at me on Twitter, I do have some CD keys that I was able to acquire that will get you this game at a significant discount. So hit me up
at NBC. What system?
It's out on PC, Xbox One, PS4, Commodore 64.
Ooh, I have a PC.
Huh? I have a Commodore 64, so I'll be playing that version.
Yeah, I think they made some graphical sacrifices to get it running on the Commodore.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
As long as it's still 60 frames a second, I'm fine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's 60 frames a second. It's great. It is. No, not on the Commodore, but on PC. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, on the Commodore, but that's fine.
Either way. The Commodore is 6.4 frames per second.
Very cool. Also, today, the Blu-ray came out.
Yep, I already ordered it.
So, you're all about that.
Yes. Witness me!
Yeah.
So, I'm going to go to Target on the way home, is what you're telling me.
You might have to.
Okay.
Dell doesn't have to, is what he's saying.
But I'll be able to watch it tonight.
I can wait.
Okay. Cool.
I got Mad Max.
He knows how it ends.
I know. I've seen it. No, I got Mad Max downloaded in the other room. I'll be playing it in just a minute here. So. Okay.
All right. What about you, Aaron? What are you excited about this week?
I'm excited about Ryu. So I was torn about what to be excited about. But I'm excited about Ryu, which is a game I picked up at Gen Con that I don't think is out yet, wide release, where you are building mechanical dragons. I finally got to play this game. You choose from races like goblins, Amazons, reptilians, shark men being my personal favorite. And basically, you live on this world where you're on peaks that are above water that used to be the tallest mountain range until the dragon Ryu abandoned the world and it was flooded with tears. And so now the dragon Ryu is returning. A prophecy has told everyone that. So all the races are attempting to build the coolest, like, mechanical dragon in order to woo him and win the game. So you have 9 islands set in a circle, and you move about those islands trying to build the pieces of your dragon. You do that with a bunch of different resources that you're allowed to trade via the taking the actions of the islands. On your turn, you can either take an action and move two and take the action, or move 4 and take no action. Anytime you take an action with an island, you flip it over, so it starts to make dead islands until the last island would be flipped over, and when you do that, the rest of them come back up. And it's really cool. It's a very simple Euro. Other than that, it's resource management. The Ring of Island mechanic, or a Ring of Islands mechanic, is very cool and very fun. It has some kind of probability manipulation stuff. It does have a fair number of wooden cubes, so I enjoy it. It also has dragon meeples that you're moving
around. Okay, I'm back in. I was out earlier in that sentence. I'm back in.
But yeah, it's a really great game. I thought it was really fun, really good. So far, I have one game left as far as board games I bought at Gen Con that I haven't got to the table. And so far, I feel pretty good about all of my purchases from Gen Con.
Nice.
So,
and that was a lot of purchases too.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, that has been the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you've been listening on iTunes, you can, of course, subscribe to the show. You can also give us a 5-star review on iTunes. We greatly, greatly appreciate that. If you decide to give us a 5-star review, Dell, we'll read it on the air in the voice of your choice. Also, we found out that, unbeknownst to us, our show is being syndicated on another stream, the RPG Podcast stream, because we're part of the RPG Podcast site, and they are taking all of those people's podcasts and putting them in their own iTunes feed. We were told this by someone who was unhappy that that was happening. We talked about it, and we decided, you know what? We don't really care too much. It does seem weird that they would put our show on there without asking us, but at the end of the day, lots more people listen to us, and we want more people to listen to us. However, if you like our show and you're listening to us on the RPG Podcasts feed, please go to iTunes and subscribe to NPC Cast as well, our show, because eventually those subscriber numbers are going to mean stuff to us, and we want to know how many people are listening to the show, because right now we have 2 subscribers, and my mom said she described 3 times. So I don't know how that works out.
She subscribed all of those times to the RPG Podcasts.
Oh, feed, so. She was the wrong feed?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably what happens. Anyways, if you have been listening on Stitcher Radio, we appreciate you as well. You can, of course, give us a thumbs up, add us to your favorites list on Stitcher. That helps us out in the Stitcher algorithms. And Stitcher is what, Aaron?
Stitcher is like Pandora for podcasts.
It is. Does Pandora exist anymore?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's like Pandora for podcasts. You listen to our cast, and it will suggest other podcasts that are like ours based on the listeners that think that they're both cool. So please like us or favorite us on Stitcher as well. Of course, there's one thing that we actively ask all of our listeners to do, and it's really the most important thing that you can do to help us out. And what is that, Del?
Witness me!
Okay, what is that, Aaron?
Tell a friend.
Yeah, tell
to
a friend.
Witness you. No.
No. Yes, tell a friend about NPC Cast, and you can do that via social media by sharing our shows, sharing our Facebook posts or Twitter posts, statuses, whatever they are.
That was that United Front tweet that we talked about.
Yeah, I need to quell this immediately. Of course, you can just tell them face-to-face as well, but word of mouth is the best form of advertisement, and we greatly appreciate all the work that you guys do on our behalf. Okay, whew. On that note, you can now add 1,000 XP to your character sheets, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. NPC Cast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/NPCcast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.
This podcast is a part of the Signals Media All-Star Network. For more information on this and other fine shows, go to signalsmedia.com. It's okay to stick our stuff in your ears. Really?